Thursday, February 21st, and today we're going to talk about rail, and I want to make a point before we start. As we are in the latter stages of the session, things happen that sometimes we can't predict, and the members of the Senate are asked to be on the floor at 1:30 for voting on bills today, and so my intent is to go as long as we can today before they call us and tell us we have to be on the floor and hear from as much as possible, and then if we can get back to other folks, we will do that. If it looks like it's going to be a short time on the floor, we might recess and come back, but we have to, in any case, our time allotment is done at 3 o'clock. So we will do the best we possibly can to hear as much about rail issues and the overall situation we're facing in the state has become very apparent to the committee that this is going to be a topic that we need to really delve into during the interim and how we can make sure that our rail infrastructure in many ways is working and that our partnerships are providing the necessary services to the state and how we can be a better partner in that. So with that in mind, I want to start with some folks who I know have traveled here, because some other people are here all the time, are a bit more flexible. So I would ask that Terry Finn of BNSF and Anne-Marie Lundberg of Tangent Services come forward, who are not regulars in the Capitol, to talk with us first. And thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. I'm Terry Finn, representing Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway here today. Thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit about rail in Oregon to you. As you know, BNSF, while maybe number one in our own minds, is not the largest railroad in Oregon, but we're hoping to get larger. We operate about 235 miles of track, and we have trackage rights over an additional 152 miles, I believe. And as you probably already know, our main line for about 10 miles runs into from the Columbia River into Portland. It's kind of the key main line into the Portland Triangle. The rest of our trackage, for products and trains going east, they use the Washington side of the Columbia River routes, crossing south again east of the Dalles, and then following the Oregon trunk south through the state into California. We own the Columbia River Bridge, which is the main crossing to the Portland area, responsible for shipping lots of containers and products both ways, north and south, on our lines, and we are the main route between Seattle and Tacoma for Portland. As we look to the future of rail in Oregon, a couple of things occur to us. One is that rail transportation is probably easily the most efficient mode of transportation over land in terms of moving large volumes for long distances. You really can't compete with truck service and shorter hauls. But rising fuel costs, growing concerns about climate change, worsening highway congestion, all are setting up conditions that are driving business toward rail as a form of transportation. The federal government and the states, particularly coastal states involved in trade, international trade, are focusing more on rail as a transportation mode that's key to the federal and state economies. Intermodalism, that is containerized forms of shipping, and standardization in the industry has added to the popularity of rail. And even so, in Oregon, actually one of our largest customers, maybe the largest customer for BNSF, is actually the J.B. Hunt Company that piggybacks truck trailers on our rail cars for shipping east. When I say long distance, that we're the most competitive mode for long distances, I'm talking usually distances in excess of 500 or 600 miles. And frankly, most of our intermodal traffic, containerized trains, would really be going 1,000 miles at a minimum. So most of it goes to Chicago and other markets to the east. So that's really what we're talking about when we talk about intermodalism. The undeniable trend for increasing interest in rail transportation by state and federal governments opens up a question: how best do we move forward in investments in rail? What are wise moves for a public body for the state to make in trying to expand rail capacity. From the perspective of a Class 1 railroad, one of the suggestions that we have and something that I talk to a lot of people about is to follow the market. Try to determine what the market is already doing in terms of where rail transportation works and where it might not work. The large rail companies adjust their business plans to capture growing and emerging markets. They change these plans all the time. Not all the time, but I mean, they have to be somewhat flexible. And it's relatively easy to see in the private sector that the investments go where the business is. Trying to redirect market forces by building facilities in the hope that if we build it, they will come. My suggestion is to avoid that kind of thinking, because I can point to at least certainly a couple of projects out of the state of Oregon where there have been millions of dollars in state and federal money pumped into the project as an intermodal facility, and they have yet to move a single rail car, containerized rail car yet, because frankly they're built where it's competitive with trucking rates and in some cases river barging, which is still a cheaper form of transportation. This kind of leads us to another truism, I think, for Class 1 railroads that sometimes leads to conflict within states and with our short line colleagues. That's that increasingly the large railroads want to move long, long, full trains of goods. The mainline capacity in Oregon and certainly in Washington is such that there is little room in terms of space or time on the mainline to, say, shuttle or switch 6 or 10 or 15 cars off and on the mainline. It's just like running an extra train. It fills up a slot. What we really like to do is the hook and haul business model, create large trains at where the cargo originates at the railhead, haul it as long and as far as we can, and dump it all off in one block. If I were trying to advise state investors, I think that it's important that they try to identify ways and locations where short lines or other facilities can assemble relatively large trains so that immediate an economy of scale that allows us to economically enter the main line with those kind of trains and haul to their destination. Standardization in this industry, the growth of unit trains, 110-car trains for container trains, grain trains, which are 110 or sometimes 55-car trains. A lot of this is actually controlled not just by the railroad. It's what grain elevators want. It has to do with how many trains circulate around in a grain elevator, for instance, to fill a grain tanker. Rather, they would like to do that, say, with two large grain trains rather than shuttling in 6 or 7 trains, because that takes a much longer time. You have a ship sitting there that wants to really head back over the Pacific to its destination. And these kind of economies and standards that are somewhat dictated by global trade are also part of the reason why the railroad works as it does these days. So I'll leave you with that, and I would like to say that congratulate the state of Oregon and the Department of Transportation, especially the rail division in this state. It has for taking a very straightforward and I think courageous look. I also work in Washington State, and they're still somewhat hung up on how to make investments or whether to make investments in certain kinds of rail. And I don't see that in this state, and even though there's not enough money in either state to do all the stuff that needs to be done, I think this state is a very straightforward and transparent attempt at dealing with these issues. So I look forward to working with you and with the DOT.
Thank you much, Mr. Finn. I think we'll go to Ms. Lundberg, and then we'll see.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anne Marie Lundberg, and I work for Tangent Services
in Portland, Oregon. We are a railroad consulting firm dealing with strategic issues with the Class 1 and the short line railroads. And I'd like to start off by saying we all know that freight is growing and that's an issue, and certainly a recognized issue and discussed issue both in the state and in the region, which is a very positive thing. And the other thing I'd like to say is that Oregon has a tremendous rail infrastructure network. We've got vast parts of the state covered both by both Class 1s, the two largest carriers in the United States, and we have wide swaths of the state that have rail infrastructure serviced by the short line railroads. And of course, the challenge for you all is where do you make the strategic investments that are going to net the economic benefits and accommodate the growth moving into the future? That's really the question. And while Terry started off saying that investment in facilities can be a dangerous thing, and I fully agree with that, I also believe that there is a need for strategic investment in facilities as well as infrastructure. Infrastructure investments are also certainly needed for capacity. We have, as Senator George was saying before the committee started, major investments were made many hundred or many tens of years ago, decades ago, and those have really run a lot of their lifespan, and it's time now to make investments for the future in the infrastructure. But if we do not address the fundamental business models that would support that infrastructure, it will be stranded investment. And that's particularly true on the short line network. So we have a tremendous asset in the state. We just need to know how to invest in it and how best to utilize it. As Terry said, the Class 1 operating model out of need is moving towards higher and higher efficiencies, which means basically connecting major hub to major hub. The major hub in the state of Oregon is the Portland metropolitan area, and most of the mainline operations are geared towards moving long trains from that hub to other hubs east of here to serve all the products that are both imported into this state as well as the products that are generated domestically and or locally and regionally, and also to bring manufactured product in from other parts of the country. So that's the mainline operating model. The short lines, then, their job is to aggregate, as Terry said, hopefully in large blocks, aggregate the small volumes around the state on their networks and then interchange them strategically with the Class 1 railroads. Now, that's kind of the trick, because either they need to interchange somewhere in the Portland area, which makes it all well and good where their hubs are, but what if you've got the Central Oregon and Pacific in the south? Yes, they can interchange in Eugene. What about all the stuff going south? How's that going to move south? Can more go south? Perhaps. And if they don't have a train that's long enough, then it means more handling in the Eugene yard before it goes south. So the trick is, how do you, one, invest in the Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad so that it can handle larger volumes, and then how do you build the business so, in fact, that these volumes will exist and will maintain the investment that the state perhaps makes? How do you build that business case? One of the things that we would like to, and one more thing I'd like to echo that Terry said, is that trucking firms absolutely are using more and more rail. Historically, as you all know, that's been a very antagonistic at times relationship, but it's not just the main, the big national carriers like J.B. Hunt and Schneider. If you look at market transport in Portland or the regional carriers such as Swift and Gordon Trucking, they are also becoming more and more in need of utilizing the rail network. And that's because of the increased cost of fuels and the difficulties with recruiting long-haul truck drivers. Another Oregon industry that could really use a rail model because of the shortcomings of the trucking industry right now is the nurseries, the nursery stock. People have been looking for years. How can you handle effectively and efficiently nursery stock by rail? And there's been some test movements and so forth, but we need to take those next steps beyond just fixing the infrastructure and figuring out what is the business model and the operating model that's going to keep this sustainable. So what's the answer now that I've set up the whole problem? One thing we would like the state to consider is looking at strategic locations for multimodal logistics centers. And this would be in the off areas. In Portland, obviously, velocity and infrastructure and keeping the main lines fluid and the connectivity is vital. But what about the Rogue Valley? What about Coos Bay? What about the Bend, Redmond, Prineville area? And even what about communities such as the Port of Morrow in Boardman that is directly adjacent to the main line? But you can't just, as Terry said, build a spur anymore and expect that the railroad's going to serve it. So how are they going to effectively connect into the mainline network. Well, we believe that if we could find locations and look at all freight that's moved into and out of an area, one of the issues that we come up against quite a bit is there really isn't adequate data to capture all freight moving into and out of a region. You can kind of guess at the truck volumes. The rail volumes are much easier to identify, but as we know, truck volumes are much larger. And getting a real number on truck volumes and what might be convertible to rail is difficult, and some additional data really does need to be collected on that. But in those areas, if we could look at what is the total movement of freight into and out of a region, where is it originating, where is it destined for, and let's find out, and then find a strategic location to develop a transportation node, a transportation hub. And, of course, that brings in things like land use planning, zoning, highway interchanges, because you will need both the trucking companies located there as well as the railroad. And it has to be on a rail location, and it has to be at a high-capacity road and rail corridor. We have to have the good market data that shows, in order to research this and determine where those strategic locations are, what is truly convertible here. And we've done some preliminary investigation into the Rogue Valley, for example, and there are lots of products that move by truck that are low-value products that are not in need of high speed transportation services, and they have to move by truck simply because there is no other option to the locations that they're looking at. So if we could capture that and find out what's convertible to rail, and also what we hear from the trucking industry is bring it on, because what we need is we need that rail option as well moving forward. One mode alone will not, or even two or three modes, all the modes need to be actively and strategically engaged in order to make this work for the long term. So I think that there is a tremendous opportunity because of this rail network that we have across this state that really is superior to what we see in other states. But the challenge, of course, is finding out how do we build the business case once the infrastructure investment is made, how do we sustain it over the long term so that it really will function into the future and build that business. And I think that has to be done by looking at all freight and looking at it holistically and how it fits into the network and fitting in with the Class 1 operating model as well as with the short line operating model. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Lundberg. I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to ask Bruce Carswell to come up from Portland Western, one of our short lines, and then the other three folks we have are regulars in the Capitol, so if we get them later today or whatever, I want to make sure that these folks who have come in to talk with us, that we have an interchange with them and get the perspective of our short lines. And Mr. Carswell, we've seen a lot of each other lately, and it's been really enjoyable. So I appreciate you coming back again today.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Metzger and the members of the committee. My name is Bruce Carswell. I'm president of the Portland and Western Railroad. We're the largest short line or regional railroad in the state of Oregon, and ultimately operate about 500 miles of trackage around northwestern Oregon, the Willamette Valley, along the Columbia River to Astoria and several places into the Coast Range. To back up some of the comments that were made by my esteemed colleagues, I'd say the state of the short line infrastructure in Oregon is fragile at best. Several high-profile issues have risen lately that I'm sure all of you are very aware of regarding, you know, line closures and embargoes and those sorts of things. And I think what that is just a manifestation of, you know, many years of neglect, I guess is one word to put it, but it's really more or less just a sparsity of traffic density, both when those lines were owned by Class 1 railroads, but then also, you know, after those lines were transferred to short lines. And as a result, you know, short lines have, you know, done the best they could in most cases, but ultimately you run out of, available money to invest if you're not bringing adequate monies in. And so you end up with lines like the Coos Bay with lots of tunnels and you know, large bridges that ultimately you just can't figure out how to justify how to fix up. Similar with storm damage issues on the Port of Tillamook Bay. You know, there's barely enough money on that line to keep it operating in the best of times, and when you have an event like we had last December, you're really left without any reserve funds to overcome those sorts of issues. And then even on our own line with our line down to Monroe and Dawson, where you've had you know, for many years, traffic density is well below even, you know, most recognized standards of continued viability. You eventually get to a point where, you know, the money coming in just doesn't equate to the money you need to put out. So it really does present a real challenge, not just to the businesses involved in this, but also to the policymakers, because, you know, the studies show that transportation task is growing, and it's going to grow considerably over the next 30 years, and it can't all be accommodated on the highway. So what are the alternatives? And in many cases, the alternatives will, in fact, be those short line railroads that right now are struggling for survival, but in the future are going to play a very strategic role in many locations. And how do we preserve those in the short term? Leverage the opportunities that Anne Marie was referring, as far as some of these nodal hubs, which I agree is definitely an idea for the future. Just wanted to make one comment with regards to the short lines. I mean, one of the advantages we have is because of our lower density of traffic, we do have a capacity to go out and do things that class ones would not do. And I would use an example of a move that we have going on now, where we're moving logs from a Reload in Rainier to users in Southern Oregon. And then conversely, we're moving export logs out of Southern Oregon up to Rainier to be put on ships for export. Right now, we with the business we have today and that model with a good partner, Teven Brothers Land and Timber Company, we've taken 40,000 truckloads off of I-5 and Highway 30. I mean, it's movements that were 100% truck before. We have captured just about every truckload we possibly can, and in fact, we're looking for more opportunities to expand that model. You know, this is business that a Class 1 wouldn't even think twice about looking at. But for us, it works very well. It's very profitable. We get a very good cost efficiency for the lumber users and producers. They obviously move to this model because it's lower cost for them than the movement by truck. You know, so I know there's more of those opportunities out there, and, you know, we're out there diligently trying to find them. But unfortunately, in several areas, it's, you know, there's just not enough yet to, you know, consolidate to put these sorts of ideas together. The key question, I think, in front of us right now, besides some of the more strategic issues, is what do we do about these short lines that are on the brink? You know, how do we identify which ones are strategic? Not everyone is. You know, there's, you know, and I'm sure if you're a local ag producer somewhere in eastern Oregon, every line out there is strategic. But, when there's only so much money to go around, we really got to figure out, okay, where's the best place to put it? But there are several strategic lines, not just for, you know, potential development of these of different transportation models in the future, but also potentially commuter rail. So this ODOT through this rail study that's going to be advanced, hopefully one of the things that will come out of that is starting to identify where those key corridors are, because I think the very first thing to do is figure out where those are and then come up with strategies of how we essentially hold those things in suspense, make sure they don't disappear while we develop some of these other transportation models. Because once they're gone, they're going to be very hard to recreate. It's much easier to take an existing railroad, even if it's worn out and broken down, and fix it up than it is to try to take a bike trail or even just a patch of farmland and try to turn it back into a rail corridor. That's all I have, and so I'll turn it back over to you, Senator Metzger.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carswell. Thank all three of you. I think that one thing that we will be looking at this year, and this is kind of a start for that, is looking at what role, what methodologies that I think that we as a legislature should do to try and measure, you know, not only present needs, future growth, and what is our appropriate role in helping to make that happen. I mean, we've been doing that for a long time, obviously with roads, with transit, and because of I think where there's a unique relationship with and federal control of rail, we don't have that same relationship that is obvious to us, I think, in many cases, how to make this happen. We see the issues that come up. We look at the business model that makes the Class 1s profitable and able to function. We know from our distributors, the growers, the suppliers, people who want to utilize services, who see that need, but also we understand, as you mentioned, the importance of being able to aggregate that, and it is in some cases a chicken and an egg type of situation, because as you mentioned, building facilities where there's not necessarily enough to aggregate something that can make this worth efficiently and schedule that into a line, versus the others who say, yes, we are using trucks, but we would use rail if we knew it was available, and then, you know, there would be the potential to aggregate. And as we all know, the trucking traffic is going to increase tremendously no matter what happens, that trying to maximize these facilities and play a role in our own look at transportation, you know, the certainly the importance of the fact that it meets our green benchmarks because of the emissions of rail, the efficiency of it, the fact that we're going to have a lot of growth in truck traffic, and that trucks themselves, companies, as you mentioned, are using, that you're a strategic partner with them as well. It really calls for you know, us to try to get our arms around how we help do this. And, you know, we're identifying on our highway system projects of statewide significance. On local levels, we're identifying what roads are critical arterials that need to be prioritized if you're in the city of Portland or Roseburg or anything else for the dollars that you have. And, you know, we do need to do the same thing in our rail system, is what are, with our whatever limited resources we may be putting after to partner with, what are the ones that help maintain critical infrastructure today and allow us to build for a future. And so I think we're grasping at trying to find some type of roadmap where we can be partners in our economic growth as well as our transportation growth. So this is a start, but this is helpful, and we appreciate it very much. Senator Johnson.
Two comments about partnership. The first one is Mr. Carswell mentioned the Teven Brothers. That happens to be in my district. I know the project very well. It was a Connect One project and was built very quickly, is up and functioning, and is adding tremendously to the economy of Rainier, as well as really connecting. I mean, it is not just a beauty pageant, who's the prettiest in the Connect line. I think we've forgotten the point of Connect was to really connect stuff. And I want to applaud that Teven Brothers project for doing it. The second thing is you talked about partnership, and I think as we move forward, particularly recognizing that there's so much more need than there is available resources, that partnership really means partnership. It means not closing a line with no notice to the shippers. It means that if you're going to come to the state of Oregon and look for money, that you behave like a real partner. And I'm not sure that that's always been the model recently. And doesn't have anything to do with Mr. Carswell's initiatives. So it's got to be reciprocal.
Thanks, Senator Johnson. Senator George.
Just really quickly, we've heard an awful lot about the superport in South America and trains and trucks coming into, you know, all the way from tip of South America to Anchorage, Alaska. And we know for a fact the best way to move that freight, that because it's going to be containerized, is going to be on a railroad. What is the? Is anyone planning this? How far along is this in the process? Because we had the director of ODOT tell our committee on Ways and Means Transportation that we can expect an 80% increase in truck traffic in the next 15 to 20 years. And I asked the question, how much of that is relative to this issue of the superport and the north-south connectors? Said it probably would be calculated into it. What about rail? Do we have any? Is anyone looking out and saying in the future we're going to have that port, the world will have that port, and how do we utilize rail?
Well, I, Senator, I can tell you that as far as my company goes, and I'm sure that our competitors at the UP are doing the same thing. You know, there are several port locations, usually most notably in the not so much in South America that I've heard of, but certainly in Central America and in Mexico. And we are looked at routes and various potential rail connections that extend south of the U.S. border into Mexico. I don't know that we've identified anything that works real, real well. I think that what you said is correct, that you're going to see a big surge in truck traffic before you do rail traffic south of the border. As far as the South American port, you know, you're almost getting enough distance, and with the expansion of the Panama Canal, you're almost getting enough distance where seaborne trade might begin to make some sense. And that certainly is the cheapest of all in terms of cost per unit moved. But you have to have a great distance, and that handling cost of ship is very high generally. So maybe Bruce or Anne Marie know more about that than I do, but I'm not so aware of a superport in South America that it's going to generate.
Basically,
that.
What I meant was Mexico. Mm-hmm. That's where we've seen the drawings. And the other thing is we have video of the Union Pacific operating, you know, in Mexico right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your assumption is somebody's thinking about the future. And my question is, are we thinking about the future?
I think that the mainland Mexico, I worked for the Port of Portland for 13 years, so we have a little port knowledge. But I think the mainland Mexico port connections, from what I understand, are designed, for one, there's a 100 million people consumer base in Mexico City, Guadalajara, that area. So it's certainly going to be supplying product to the local and regional market in Mexico, but the connections are mostly to the East Coast. And so I think what they're building towards is a connectivity between Mexico, where there are lower port operating costs, and moving into Atlanta, Kansas City, Chicago area from that region. But mostly the southeastern United States is where the connectivity is.
Senator Berger?
Yes, Mr. Kurzweil, you were, I thought, rather optimistic about the future of short lines. And I agree with you. I guess my question to you is, why would the short line owner in Coos Bay, which is in my district, be so hesitant to make a business investment in the line when actually there are four good companies, with American Bridge actually expanding and the possibility of profitability in the future seems to me to be very good. Can you explain to me why the hesitancy?
Well, obviously, Chair Metzger, Senator Berger, I don't know the actual business details of the profitability of that line, nor the business potential. I can speak in terms of how we approach things, and you know, we're, you know, publicly held companies, which, you know, my company belongs to one, as well as Central Oregon and Pacific, and ultimately BNS and UP, you know, very rarely are able to speculate in what I characterize as field of dreams capital investment. So we got to know what the business case is. We've done a fair amount of work on our own system based on, we know we've got business right now. If that was all we were ever going to have, we probably wouldn't invest quite as heavily as we are right now. But we know, based on both what we see in the future and our track record to this point forward, that it's growing, and it's growing at a compound annual growth rate more than adequate to sustain that investment into the future. So we'll stick our neck out a little bit, and our organization has been able to do that. I don't understand, and I don't know the business model down in Coos Bay. I know they are facing some real issues there with looming capital infrastructure cost, and I know that would give anybody pause. I do also think that there's a lot of potential down there. So I suspect it's really about, you know, trying to figure out how to balance the looming upfront costs that they have right now, and how long is it going to take to get that payback. I'm sure that's why they're hesitant. You know, they've also, I think, got a little bit different business model than fortunately our company has, and that's led to some of the issues down there. But I mean, any organization, you know, especially with those sorts of looming costs, is going to face a bit of an uphill battle with investors that typically want to have turnarounds fairly quickly as far as their return on investment.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, I just make the comment that, of course, the line was purchased and it had not been maintained for a number of years. And obviously, if you don't maintain things, they get very run down, and then they require a lot of money. But I agree with your assessment that it is a lot better to upgrade a line or repair a line than to try to let it go away and then put it back in. Mm-hmm. And we also have a brand new rail spur that is very close there, brand new, that goes out to the North Spit, that Southport. uses. So I think that there is a lot of reason, actually, if we were able to manage our natural resources the way that some of us think that we should be able to manage them, those lines would have even more business. So,
Senator Stark.
Hey, Mr. Chair. Thank you all very much for being here. I appreciate the information. The question is for Ms. Lundberg. You mentioned the idea of regional logistics centers. Is there any work going on now that you're aware of that is looking at that idea? Are you suggesting that as we progress into the next legislative session, that we as a legislature instruct the rail division to undertake such work? How do you foresee or do you envision that? Maybe it's already happening, and if it is, maybe we can talk about it a little bit, or go into a little bit more detail.
Well, I think the short lines, as Bruce will attest, are certainly aware of this and looking at their opportunities on their networks. The City of Prineville Railway, with its freight depot, is what it's calling itself in the Prineville area, is attempting exactly this type of facility. They're having difficulty connecting with the main line there. That's really a through passage, Terry. The Oregon Trunk is one that, again, connects Major Hub Portland to cities in the south for the BNSF. So you're sitting in Prineville or Bend or Redmond, and it's difficult to connect into the network. So they're doing exactly that. They're looking at trying to aggregate large volumes. They're talking to companies like Les Schwab Tires, who's traditionally been all truck into that region, to see what some of the opportunities are. They're exploring things with the BNSF to see where they can connect and how they can connect efficiently and aggregate volume. So they're certainly doing that type of thing. And I know that Bruce has been involved in many studies, including the nursery stop, to see how and when and where and why and that could happen. Albany, Lebanon area. But there are several things that need to be fixed in terms of the basic infrastructure, which the Connect Oregon 1 and 2 programs are doing. So I think there is a lot of awareness there. I know that the ODOT Rail Division, we've certainly had conversations with them through the years, and I hesitate to speak for Kelly, who's in the room, but I would assume that that would certainly be part of the consideration with the rail study moving forward on how to. That's my assumption at this point anyway, and we would certainly encourage that, and those types of recommendations then would inform you, I would imagine, on where and how and when you can make those types of investments.
Thank
and
you.
With which partners.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Larry George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for coming. I guess I want to talk a little bit about the issues of the infrastructure and maintain the current infrastructure that we have. I guess my question to you is that are there regulatory issues that we currently have, whether when you're doing improvements on lines, because you think about a lot of these lines, especially as they go over the Coast Range and other places, they cross a lot of streams, they cross a lot of what would be considered environmentally sensitive areas. Are there regulatory issues that we've put into place or the federal government put in place that are raising the cost to repair these lines, to improve these lines? What is running up the cost of repair that we would maybe even consider abandoning a line to, say, Coos Bay? Are there things that we could do that would be non-monetary, maybe regulatory enhancements or how I should say it, streamlining, so that we shorten the window of the regulatory process or, in certain circumstances, perhaps eliminate regulation that may be slowing down either infrastructure repairs or making sure we cut off abandonment if those are the issues? Are they out there? Is that what we're talking about? And are there ways for us to address those?
I'll take an initial stab at that, Senator. As far as the mainline railroads go, the Class 1s, I think that there are regulatory things that could be done. This is a bit of a confession, but if, railroads, large railroads have a reputation for moving, well, how shall I say, not very fast. But if you've ever noticed when a line goes down, if with a flood or a landslide or you have that situation now, the railroads throw millions of dollars, a lot of personnel. They get things righted fairly fast, even for large, large problems. We can build track pretty fast, but if we're slowed down by permitting issues at the state level, then and some of these issues are preempted because of the Class 1 federal preemptions, but they can still slow our response. And frankly, the part of the confession is that we don't really invest that money and do all that and for track expansion until we sort of really know in our gut and see that the business is there. We don't build things in the hopes that we will come. We kind of let things push to the limit, and then we add, we expand things.
I'll just, as a follow-up, that because railroads traditionally have fallen primarily under federal purview, and the federal guidelines are actually, you know, not as onerous as one might think, you know, from a short lines perspective, we don't see any huge barriers there. You know, when you get into a situation like the Coos Bay line, it really gets down to fundamental economics. Big timber bridges that were built 100 years ago when lumber was a fraction, or board foot of lumber was a fraction of the price it is today, you know, just are really expensive to replace these days. And similarly with a timberline tunnel and those sorts of things. It's, you know, really gets down to the change in the basic economy that's occurred since that line was built to where it is today, and the fact that the traffic it's handling and the profitability on the traffic it's handling has changed dramatically. Many of these lines, whether they're still in service today or they're now currently embargoed, really do face an issue that unless the environment changes, the long-term replacement cost of the heavy infrastructure is really not being generated. And that's even true on some of our line segments. We look at them, you know, we're earning a profit and we're putting ties and rail in, but we're not replacing bridges. And if you look at the number of bridges railroad bridges in the state of Oregon, it's a big number, not just on our railroad, but also the other short lines and even some of the class ones. And you know, bridge costs are not going down. They're going up at an exponential rate. And so those sorts of things, you usually end up in a situation eventually where you've wrung all of the asset life out of the particular structure that you can, and it's no longer safe to operate without a major infusion of cash, and ultimately then you get to a bit of an impasse if your traffic level doesn't generate that amount of revenue to justify it in a private entity.
Senator George, you have a comment.
Thanks. I brought a couple things in here today, and one of them was the report by Ann L. Gardner to O'Rourke's annual meeting last year. I want to point out, because we didn't get it noted on here, that the emphasis is ours. It was not hers. So if you're looking at this, you have to understand that highlighting was mine. I thought it was very important, though, what was said in here relative to the idea that we better be making plans for infrastructure in the future. The other thing, if we could call out of here back to the floor, I can't run a DVD for each one of the members on what the House testimony that we'll receive if we're not able to come back. So if any of you would like to have a DVD of that, I can run a copy for you.
Thanks. Senator. Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much for coming. I've asked our staff to check on the floor to see where our status is. No one's come and yelled at us yet, so I think we will continue until that time comes. Yes. Okay, let's have Kelly Taylor and Lana Butterfield and Roger Martin come forward. Have the two of you first, and because Kelly will be kind of our wrap-up, I think, from the state perspective.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rail Users League, or O-Rule. Annette Price is the president. She couldn't be here today. The only thing that I would like to especially put on the record from our written testimony is that first paragraph, because that is our mission statement. It says, O-Rule is an organization serving public and private interests that operate, utilize, and support railroads in the state of Oregon. O-Rule advocates for the rights and needs of railroads and their customers while encouraging economic growth within the state of Oregon. If you look down at our membership, you will see that we really are an umbrella organization. We have both class ones and a number of the short lines. We have several ports. We have shippers. We have a lot of vendors, engineering firms, rail car manufacturers, et cetera. And so we have some very lively meetings. You are all invited to come if you haven't been to one of these. We have quarterly meetings. We also have a wide distribution list of people who maybe haven't necessarily paid dues, but we have about 150 folks who participate. And so it's been a great organization.
Okay. We have some bills now that are coming up on the floor, so we have hit that time. We have some members that are particularly involved in. So what I'm going to do, folks, is I'm going to recess the committee. We will be going to the floor. You can observe the floor session, and if we will come back into committee after that floor session is over, unless it runs long, in which case we will discuss this afternoon, when, since we're on 1 hour notice, whether we can hear from the rest of you and have a discussion. Okay. So I apologize for that. I don't run the schedule. So at this point, we're in recess until after the floor.